WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to the Sunday Spin, the first edition for the new year of January 7th, 2018. Welcome to our weekly look inside the world of politics and policy from City Hall to the State House and all the way out to Washington, D.C. Go grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll all do our best to get your week off to a great start. Merry Christmas, Sam Panayotovich.
Christos Serodi is how we say it.
Okay, I'll let you say that.
Maybe not you, maybe we.
Okay.
That's how we say it, not how you say it.
Well, I will say Merry Christmas again.
Thank you, Rick.
I hope you have a great great holiday Sunday. Thanks for joining us this Sunday.
No problem. Sure.
And then now that we've heard from Doc Emmerich about what's wrong with our Blackhawks, and I agree, the defense is the big thing. And I was so disappointed after this long road trip that Vegas Knights come in, and an amazing record for an expansion team. But we had that game. And we gave it away. And the defense gave it away. And I'm going to make some split pea and ham soup tonight because I think that's kind of rejuvenating with all of the cold weather we've been having. And you know, watch the Blackhawks with that and this afternoon. And hopefully they'll get rejuvenated too. Because it's time to start kicking here, guys. I mean, playoffs are coming, and we're not there.
Is that a panic soup for you, or is that like a calming soup?
It's a calming. It's a it's comforting.
Okay,
it's a comforting thing. Do I sound panicked?
No,
you sound concerned.
Yes, concerned is the right word.
You sound concerned.
Some soups you go to when you really need something to go the right way, and I feel like split pea and ham is one of those soups.
Yeah, I mean, I have to tell you, even though it was a short week last week, it was an extremely busy week and an exhausting week. And quite frankly, I'm not sure if it was exhausting just because of this cold weather snap. Hopefully, that will be snapped today. I don't know if it's the cold weather or if it's from putting on the various layers of clothing to try to stave it off.
That's part of it.
I mean,
it really is.
I think it is. I think there's something to it because it was just hard to get the engine turned over, you know? And
the fact that it's gone on for the length of time that it has.
Well, somewhere I read that this was like the longest below 20 degree streak since 1936.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, this wasn't just for a couple days. This has been since Christmas.
Right.
December 25th, Christmas.
Yeah, you're right.
And it,
like I said, it's just exhausting. And thankfully, you know, I don't know. It's like I don't want the weekend to end, but I kind of want the weekend to end because now we're going to be getting warmer temperatures. And hopefully that'll balance off the work week that's ahead.
We do have precipitation, though, with these warmer temperatures. And the fact that the temperatures will be hovering around freezing with freezing rain, do be careful on the roads.
Yeah, I want to emphasize that.
For that matter, if you're walking, you know, even though it's a city ordinance to keep the sidewalks shoveled, some of them that I've seen are not.
Right.
And they will be extra slick when those temperatures get up to around 30.
Well, and then you get a little bit of a melt, and then it refreezes and that
right,
kind of thing.
Right, exactly.
And freezing rain is absolutely the worst. I mean,
yeah.
And back when I was going to school down in the Metro East area in Edwardsville, and they don't really get snow.
No, they get those ice storms are terrible down there.
They're terrible. Basically, you can't defrost, your windshield defroster doesn't work fast enough sometimes.
When you have a half inch thick ice on there.
Yeah, I mean, I remember getting out of my car on a hill and going sliding underneath the door of the car to
Wait
the bottom of the hill.
There's hills down there?
Yes.
Are there really?
Well, yes, this is not central Illinois.
No.
You're starting
Edwardsville,
to get
Alton, yes, there are hills there.
You would know.
Wow. That makes it even worse then.
Yeah. your brakes, you know, you just go sliding. And with the chance of freezing rain, everybody just please extra caution on this, because, like I said, I don't think there's anything nastier than that. I probably made a mistake, and I stayed up and watched. I thank goodness I'm not a Kansas City Chiefs fan. Because after, you know, I watched the first half of that game against Tennessee, and Kansas City is really, their offense can do no wrong.
21-3.
At half, yes. 21-3 at the half.
They didn't score again.
I know. And they're at Arrowhead Stadium in Kansas City on top of it.
And it's only fitting the Bears really like the Kansas City offensive coordinator. They love Matt Nagy, who
really
called the plays, ironically enough, in that second half when Kansas City did not score.
And played conservatively. I know their big tight end was taken out.
Yeah, Kelce had a concussion.
Concussion, right. But it, I mean, and what a great player. There's no doubt about it. But it was like they decided in the second half just to play conservative football, and it cost them. As it normally does, you start playing conservatively, and I know that I've got friends out in Missouri, and my Twitter feed was just exploding from that game, and I can't remember the last time Kansas City actually won a playoff game. I mean, they've been in several.
They've lost their last six at home.
Wow.
Last six playoff games at home, but to be outscored 19-0 in the second half at home.
Oof. Yeah, and that's what the Twitter feed was kind of on that. It's like, you know, talk about losing in the worst way possible. That absolutely was it. But so who are the Bears going to get for a coach?
They really like this Eagles quarterbacks coach, John DeFilippo. He's sort of like the quarterback whisperer. He had a really good season with Carson Wentz in Philly. Wentz, before he got hurt,
right,
was like on MVP-type numbers. So they like him. They also like Pat Shurmur, who's the Vikings offensive coordinator, but they're going to go with an offensive mind. You've got to pair somebody with a sharp mind with Trubisky. That's the plan, and that's certainly going to be what happens.
Yeah, I've got to figure it's got to be an offensive-minded offensive coordinator, something like that. Especially, you know, with a young quarterback, a new quarterback, and you just hope they mesh, whoever it may be, with Trubisky. That's because we can't endure much more of this from the Chicago Bears. I don't think anybody can. I mean, it's like it's just frustrating. It's hard to be a Bears fan. And that was the number one team in Chicago, was the Chicago Bears. And now, you know, who watches them?
Yeah.
What can you say? Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Sam,
and one
has,
more
yes,
quick note
yes,
here, Rick,
yes.
Since we've been talking about the weather and everything
Please.
Else. A bright spot here,
yeah.
A little sunshine schwanny for the first Sunday in the new year. Less than 7 weeks before spring training begins.
How
Pitchers
about
and
that?
Catchers report February 23rd. Does that sound right, Sam?
I'm sorry, one more time, Shawnee?
Pitchers and catchers report February 23rd. I believe that's when the first pitchers and catchers starts.
Yeah, it sounds less than
seven.
I think it was earlier
weeks.
Than that. But
is
yeah,
it earlier?
Give or take, it's coming right around the corner.
Yep. There's my bright spot for the morning.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it. Feel free to jump in anytime with that kind of news.
You bet.
That's Dave. He's got he'll keep us up to date on all the news. Sam has the latest sports. Producer Kassir is here to field your calls at 312-981-7200. You can text us at 312-981-7200. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter @SymbolSundaySpin. Engineer Bob is here looking for his left glove. As always, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com, and you can also get our podcasts at iTunes by searching for My Name, Rick Pearson. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, after we catch up on the news and sports at 7:30, we'll speak to Chuck Holland, the president and CEO of St. Bernard Hospital in Englewood. We'll also speak to Democratic State Representative Juliana Stratton of Chicago, and they're here to talk about the renewal working on the renewal of the state's hospital assessment program that generates federal Medicaid funding for safety net hospitals. After the 8 o'clock news, we'll speak to Dr. Dan Lustig. He's president and CEO of the Haymarket Center, and Haymarket is facing opposition over seeking an opioid treatment facility in Wheaton. We're going to talk about the opioid epidemic and the need for facilities to help treat people who are abusing opioids. It is an epidemic. After we get the latest news at 8:30, we'll then speak to Democratic Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy of Schaumburg. He's a member of the House Oversight Committee, and he's asking for Steve Bannon to appear before that committee in the wake of revelations from the book, The Fire and Fury. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pierce from the Chicago Tribune. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics, and what a first week of 2018 it's been. President Trump bragging on Twitter that his nuclear button is bigger than Kim Jong-un's in North Korea, even though there is no nuclear button. He raged about a new book from Michael Wolff, Fire and Fury, which basically described an unhinged White House and a president who only looks to boost his own image at the expense of public policy. Trump tried to block the book's release, a legal move that really wouldn't work. And Wolff's work got Trump and his former White House strategist, Steve Bannon, into a war in which many critics say they can't pick a winner. Despite some glaring errors and a gossipy style, Wolff's book does back up a number of previously reported stories about the first year at the White House. The author appeared on NBC's Today Show on Friday and said everyone he interviewed had a common description of Donald Trump.
I will tell you the one description that everyone gave, everyone has in common. They all say he is like a child. And what they mean by that is he has a need for immediate gratification. It's all about him. I mean, this letter for the cease and desist letter, I mean, I still have sources in the White House, and I know everybody was going, we should not be doing this. This is not smart. And he just insists. He just has to be satisfied in the moment.
Now, Wolff has previously reported on Steve Bannon, and it's clear the two have a past history. Bannon accused Donald Trump Jr. of engaging in a traitors meeting at Trump Tower in hopes of getting dirt from Russia on Hillary Clinton. Wolff says Trump is making a mistake by trying to make it appear that the book is really about Steve Bannon.
This book is not about Steve Bannon. This book is about Donald Trump. As for Steve Bannon, and I spoke to Steve as I spoke to many people throughout the length of the reporting here, and really saw a transformation, not only of Steve, but of everyone, but Steve in a way is most vivid, or his language is the most vivid.
And
the transformation was, you know, we thought this presidency could work. We thought Donald Trump is an interesting, unique character, and we might be able to do something here. And they saw him over that time come to the conclusion he cannot do this job.
Now, the book has, of course, stirred up Donald Trump on Saturday after Fox News reported about media questions about the president's mental stability stirred by the book, while Trump took to Twitter where he said, quote, my two greatest assets have been mental stability and being, like, really smart, unquote. He also tweeted that by winning the presidency on his first try, quote, I would think that would qualify as not smart, but genius, and a very stable genius at that. Trump also called the author of the book a loser, said Bannon cried and begged for his job when he got fired. Later, at Camp David, Trump had more to say.
And what I was heartened by, because I talk about fake news and the fake news media, was the fact that so many of the people that I talk about in terms of fake news actually came to the defense of this great administration and even myself, because they know the author and they know he's a fraud. And what I saw some of the people say, and you look at some of his past books, he did a book on Rupert Murdoch. It was a terrible expose, and it was false. So much of it was false. I consider it a work of fiction. And I think it's a disgrace that somebody's able to have something, do something like that. The libel laws are very weak in this country. If they were strong, it would be very helpful. You wouldn't have things like that happen where you can say whatever comes to your head. But just so you know, I never interviewed with him in the White House at all. He was never in the Oval Office. We didn't have an interview. And I did a quick interview with him a long time ago having to do with an article. But I don't know this man. I guess Sloppy Steve brought him into the White House quite a bit, and it was one of those things. That's why Sloppy Steve is now looking for a job.
Sloppy Steve, a reference to Steve Bannon, his former chief strategist in the White House. Now, as for tweeting out about the fact that he considers himself to be a genius, Trump said Wolf made up concerns about his mental stability.
I went to the best colleges or college. I went to I had a situation where I was a very excellent student, came out, made billions and billions of dollars, became one of the top business people, went to television, and for 10 years was a tremendous success, as you probably have heard. Ran for president one time and won. And then I hear this guy that doesn't know me at all. By the way, did not interview me for three, said he interviewed me for 3 hours in the White House. It didn't exist, okay? It's in his imagination.
Now, Trump also labeled as false a New York Times story that had him trying to force Attorney General Jeff Sessions to stop trying to recuse himself from the Russia investigation. Here's the president.
Everything that I've done is 100% proper. That's what I do, is I do things proper. And, you know, I guess the collusion now is dead, because everyone found that after a year of study, there's been absolutely no collusion. There has been no collusion between us and the Russians. Now, there has been collusion between Hillary Clinton, the DNC, and the Russians. Unfortunately, you people don't cover that very much, but the only collusion is between Hillary and the Russians, and the DNC and the Russians.
Now, as if the book details and the president's response haven't been crazy enough, even former short-term White House spokesman Anthony Scaramucci showed up. Yes, the Mooch is back. The Mooch was on MSNBC, where he appeared to defend Donald Trump Jr. from Bannon's remarks in the book about that meeting being treasonous. Here's Anthony Scaramucci.
If Steve said, because there's a lot of stuff in that book that I don't believe is true, we can go over that, but if Steve said that that was treasonous, he should issue a retraction immediately, and he should issue an apology to Donald J. Trump Jr., because he is an American patriot. He did absolutely nothing treasonous. We can talk about the judgment of having the meeting or not having the meeting. I'm sure he regrets having the meeting, but it's not treasonous. Okay,
what does it mean to say, though?
It's an obviously wrong thing to say about somebody whose family has put everything on the line for America.
That's the Mooch. Anthony Scaramucci is back.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Just out on the WGN Storm Center patio where it's that balmy 15 degrees, but watching the weather forecast, 49 on Thursday.
I'll take it.
49.
We were looking at warming temperatures, you know, the last few days. And the good news there is that they got gradually warmer as we got closer to the start of the week.
Well, it's like I said, I'm so looking forward to it. But then the temperatures go back into the 20s, and then we'll be complaining about that, right?
Oh, yeah.
Even though, like I said, it's a balmy 15 degrees out there right now.
Yeah.
Thank goodness we're finally going to break this cold spell. Oh,
you know what? If you want to get technical, Rick, since we're close to the lakefront, it's 17 at the lakefront.
Oh, so okay. Well, maybe that explains. That's that extra
why
2 degrees.
It feels so good.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks a lot, Dave. Well, I'm here in the Allstate Showcase studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue, and joining me here in studio is Chuck Holland. He's the president and CEO of St. Bernard Hospital in Englewood. Along with him is State Representative Juliana Stratton, Democrat from Chicago. I'll also point out that she is the Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor on the J.B. Pritzker ticket. both of you, thank you for coming in this morning. And I know it's early, but I appreciate it. But I think this is a subject that deserves some attention. This is the issue of these safety net hospitals that serve vital areas, and the fact that for years we've had what's known as the hospital assessment program, and this is a way to generate funds from the federal government for Medicaid funds that are part of the vital funding of these vital hospitals. And right now it's hung up in negotiations, and time's kind of running out. The clock is running out, and that always seems to be the case here when it comes to fiscal matters in Illinois. But first, Chuck, if you could explain, what is a safety net hospital?
Sure, Vic. Thanks for having me this morning. A safety net hospital is a hospital that serves 50% or greater Medicaid patients on an inpatient basis. So, for instance, St. Bernard Hospital, which I'm the CEO of, serves 80% of its patients on Medicaid. That's a huge percentage. And Medicaid, you know, pays about 50 to 70% of the cost of care. So we're actually spending money on care that we're not being recouped for through the Medicaid program. So a safety net hospital serves the most vulnerable in our populations and serves communities where those patients really need critical access to care.
Has Obamacare helped as far as that population, that population in need that would traditionally, you know, be covered by Medicaid, and the expansion of Medicaid under Obamacare?
Sure. Obamacare did help by expanding Medicaid in Illinois and also providing insurance for those that were above the limits for Medicaid but couldn't afford the cost of insurance before. So it has helped. Provides insurance for people who didn't have it before, and as I said, expanded Medicaid to certain others in the population.
Juliana, the hospital assessment program, I mean, I know what it is, but I don't think most people understand really how this hospital assessment program works. Mm-hmm. Could you explain what that is?
Sure. Well, first of all, good morning, and thank you for this opportunity to be here. This is an important issue, and when we talk about the hospital assessment program, we're really looking at an assessment on hospitals that then can be matched by the federal government, which then brings in funds to provide medical care and services to Illinoisans. So it's really important to make sure that in terms of expanding this care and making sure that people have access to quality health care, that and in particular for these safety net hospitals that we're talking about this morning, that we continue to keep these funds coming in. Now, under the Illinois Hospital Assessment Program that we have right now, it sunsets on July 1st, 2018. So we really have to make sure that we get this new funding formula passed so that we can get make sure that there's no interruption of services to either the safety net hospitals or any of the hospitals that are benefiting from this care.
Now, of course, July 1st, start of the state budget year, and, you know, we're 6 months away, roughly. And people might say, well, why is there a time crunch?
Well, my understanding is is that typically there have been this is something that the federal government has to approve. And my understanding is it's typically been up to 1 to 2 years for the federal government to do that. Well, now, here we are about 6 months out from when this assessment will sunset. And so we have, we're heading back to session in the General Assembly later this month. And during that time, we have to get this passed. The second thing is that the working group on this assessment has been meeting for several months, and there has not been consensus at this point, meeting both with the Illinois Hospital Association as well as the Illinois Department of Health Care and Family Services. There's not been an agreement yet about what this will look like. So we're sort of under the crunch of getting this getting this agreement so that then we can get something passed in the General Assembly.
Well, Chuck, I mean, what's at stake here as far as the what we're talking about, dollars, and not just dollars, but we're talking jobs, all those kinds of things.
Yeah, that's a good question. Let me give you a very concrete example. At my hospital, the assessment brings in $28 million a year to my hospital, and that helps cover the cost of care that's not covered by reimbursement through Medicaid, through rate reimbursement. When we send a bill to the Medicaid office or to MCOs and we get paid, it helps cover that gap between the payment, the lack of payment from traditional Medicaid payments and the cost of care. So it's essential to my hospital. It's about 30% of my hospital budget, and it's essential to other safety nets. The whole purpose of the assessment program was to distribute money to safety nets to help recoup the cost of care that they...
Because they know, I mean, with the knowledge that there is going to be this uncompensated
this,
care.
Correct. That the care is uncompensated and needs to be made up. Without this assessment, if this assessment is not passed, hospitals will lay off employees. Safety net hospitals could be forced to close. And these are hospitals that are often the largest employers in their neighborhoods. In my neighborhood, for instance, in Englewood, my hospital employs 850 people. 30% of those people live within our primary service area. If we lose this money, if this assessment is not passed, if there isn't fair distribution of the assessment dollars to safety net hospitals, we certainly will have to lay off people, and we'll have to, you know, we're in danger of closing, as are other safety net hospitals.
And I think if I could just add to that, it's absolutely important to recognize the jobs that are in these communities. And sometimes, you know, most of the people who are working at many of these safety net hospitals are people from that very community. Many of these communities are, they are primarily low-income communities, primarily communities of color. So when we talk about safety net hospitals or even the critical access facilities in rural areas, this is the largest employer, as Chuck has already mentioned. My very first job actually was at St. Bernard Hospital. And I have, my dad has been on staff at safety net hospitals, and so we are, I've lived my whole life recognizing the importance of these institutions in communities that, but for these safety net hospitals, they would not have access to quality care. But I think when we think about all of the challenges that we have in the state, so many of them can be tied to the fact that people do not have access to quality care. And so it's important to think about what happens when someone, you know, what happens when we don't have people have access to a hospital, when they can get the kind of preventive care that they need, when people, we have lower production rates because people can't go to work because of health care issues, when children can't go to school and learn. All of the things that we say we value in Illinois can often be at stake when we don't have healthy communities and healthy individuals, and access to health care helps with that. And so we have to make sure that we continue this care for these safety net hospitals.
Plus, you know, with concern about these neighborhoods and issues of kind of touchstone institutions like schools and
Absolutely.
Those kinds of things where you food deserts, the whole issue of the economics and economic concerns that may lead to crime. And
well, food deserts, but we also are at risk of hospital deserts. You know, for many people, this is the one institution, and these are anchor institutions. And so just like we talk about a school and the need for healthy communities to have a school that's present and good quality education, that same need exists for quality health care. We need these anchor institutions providing quality health care in the communities where people can not only get services, but people can also work and therefore contribute to the economy of the community.
Well, and goes to the larger question of health care is a right.
I mean, absolutely.
It's not an affordability issue.
That's right.
And that, I mean, I think most people agree with that. It's, but it's trying to make these complicated things like a hospital assessment program work in order to leverage the money to keep the institutions alive and functioning. We're speaking with Chuck Holland, President and CEO of St. Bernard Hospital in Englewood, and State Representative Juliana Stratton of Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, joined here in the Allstate Showcase Studio by Chuck Holland, President and CEO of St. Bernard Hospital in Englewood, and State Representative Julia Stratton, a Democrat from Chicago. We're talking about the issue of the state's hospital assessment program, and this is a program that is used to leverage federal Medicaid dollars that can in turn be used to help what's known as safety net hospitals, being ones who get at least 50% of their revenue from the Medicaid program. So this assessment program, $4 billion is generated by it. And from the Association of Safety Net Community Hospitals, they say if we don't reenact this, that creates a $750 million issue in the state budget. What really is going on in these negotiations, and you know, what is the give and take going on here?
Mm-hmm. So we've been meeting. There's a working group. In addition to the Illinois Hospital Association and the Illinois Department of Health Care and Family Services, we have legislators from both chambers and from both sides of the aisle. And I should say that the legislators that are part of this working group are very motivated and interested in making sure that we see safety net hospitals continue to be able to be sustained and to have the kind of funding to continue to provide the critical services that they provide to these communities. And so, there hasn't been, I think we've been having conversation. We're not quite at the place where there's agreement, but I think one of the things that we're really looking at, and I think it's been a sticking point in particular for the Rauner administration, and that is ways to maximize the federal dollars that are available, and in particular looking at this upper payment limit, and there's a lot of more complex details to this whole process, but I'll just say that to make it simple, that there are additional funds that we could perhaps leverage from the federal government. And for some reason, there's been some reluctance on the part of the administration to really help us to do that. So these conversations continue. We recognize that there is a deadline. We recognize that this is something that we have to get done. And I think that when we look at that sunset provision coming up within 6 months, less than 6 months now, that we want to make sure that there is a bridge, that there's no interruption of services. We want to make sure that that funding can continue past that point and actually get the funding that we need from and maximize the federal dollars. I mean, if there's more funding, and I don't know if you have some additional thoughts on that, Chuck, but if there's additional funding that we can get and it benefits the state of Illinois and we can get it from the federal government, then we should do everything that we can to try to access those funds. And so that's one of the things that we continue to talk about.
Yeah, and that's a real critical issue here, because there have been some proposed numbers that have come out through the Illinois Hospital Association for what hospitals will get through this assessment program, through a new assessment program. And many safety nets, in particular in Chicago, have been reduced the amount of assessment money they would get through this program, which is not sustainable. It's not sustainable for my hospital. We can't afford to lose $1. In fact, we need many millions of dollars more. So without this assessment money, without increased money going to safety nets, it's going to put the safety nets in a real bind starting in after July 2018. And as Representative Stratton said, there's some disagreement about what the upper payment limit should be. Some experts in the Medicaid side of things have said that there's upwards of $300 million more that can be matched through this program that would allow additional monies to go to safety net hospitals, which is absolutely critical for their sustainability and to provide care to the most vulnerable in our populations and our communities.
Now, you know, obviously this is a vital concern in the Chicago area.
Yes.
But it's not just Chicago.
Correct. It's throughout the state.
I mean, and there's some, as much as these hospitals serve to anchor neighborhoods in Chicago, in rural Illinois,
yes,
these hospitals, again, they're the anchor in those areas as well.
We call those rural critical access hospitals, and the same idea applies, that we need this assessment and we need to make sure that we get this funding flowing so that those institutions, which are often the only hospital or healthcare facility for miles and miles, the only one in the region or the area, also has and provides such critical services, these are the hospitals that we're also looking at as well.
Is perhaps part of the problem in this, the one factor is state reimbursement to hospitals and the level of reimbursement that
Correct.
The state provides. Is that one of the kind of
Sure.
underlying issues
well,
here?
Well, sure. As I mentioned, reimbursement really covers 50 to 70% of the actual cost of care for hospitals. And, for instance, in St. Bernard, with 80% of your patients using Medicaid as their source of payment, 20% having Medicare, there's a huge gap in the amount of revenue that comes in to cover the expense of providing that care, and that's what the assessment does. The assessment dollars help bridge that gap for safety net hospitals.
And the other hospitals?
Yeah, other hospitals can have commercial payers, commercial insurance, many more patients who have commercial insurance than, say, do safety net hospitals. At St. Bernard, we have virtually no commercial insurance payers, which means that we can't, cover the cost of care through the monies that we get from private insurers who pay more than Medicaid and pay at least the cost of care and more. But we don't have that ability to do that, and many safety nets do not have that ability to do that. Even with the assessment, many safety nets are still running a deficit, so it's critically important that those dollars get distributed to safety nets in a fair and equitable manner so that they can continue to provide care to their communities.
Representative Stratton, you touched on this. Is there a feeling now of trying to do kind of a stopgap bridge program and try to, I mean, basically where we are now, to try to tie things over until perhaps a more comprehensive program can be negotiated?
Well, I can say that the talks are continuing. You know, these conversations continue every week. The conversation continues about what we can do to actually get this program going, update it. But as I mentioned, there is a review process and approval process from the federal government, and we are certainly, you know, the time is ticking, and so we're less than 6 months away.
They're not known to move very quickly.
Well, there could be challenges with meeting the appropriate deadlines, and I guess what I'm saying is we want to make sure that this funding continues one way or the other. We certainly hope that we can get this approval and get everything going so that it is fully set come July 1st, 2018. But at the very least, I think it's really important that we do not allow these funds to expire, and we don't have funding that can continue at some level even after July 1st, 2018. So we're looking at all options. Certainly, we want the more that hospitals can have long-term, sustainability and stability, so that they can plan and make decisions about what they want to do as institutions. That's of course much better. But we certainly don't want to, whatever kind of bridge is necessary, if need be, we will explore that as well.
But certainly, given the state's financial hole, there isn't state resources.
That's right. If we can't get this funding and this process going forward, then we will be looking at a hole to the tune of about $750 million for the state of Illinois. And goodness knows we don't have those additional funds. But more importantly, this also means that it will cut off critical access to care for many people, such as developmental disabilities and other types of services that are provided by the state and covered by these funds. So this is something that will have implications for the state of Illinois, put a hole in our budget where we do not have $750 million to plug that hole from other sources. So it's really important for the safety net hospitals. It's also important for the state of Illinois in general as it continues to provide quality care.
Well, and certainly we've seen the fraying of the state's social service safety net due to the budget impasse of over 2 years. Yeah. Now you throw an issue like this into true safety net not that the others are less, but I mean, as a medical established institutions, this would seem to be something that should be an extremely high priority for everybody in Springfield.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh. Let me add, Rick, that bridge between the old program and the new program, that funding is absolutely essential for hospitals. We can't stop the funding and wait 6 months until a new program is put in place. So that funding is absolutely essential for our hospitals. So
To pick up on what you just said, when we look at the budget crisis that happened over the last 2.5 years, when we saw safety net systems not have the funding, then there are many institutions that closed down. They had to lay off so many staff, and they don't just pick up and keep going because a budget was passed this year. There was a long-term damage that was done, and that's what we want to avoid with our safety net hospitals, having some sort of period of time where they're not getting funding, where it's very hard to recover, and we certainly don't want any of these institutions to close their doors. They're just too vital to these communities.
That's Democratic State Representative Juliana Stratton from Chicago. Show. Also here, Chuck Holland, President and CEO of St. Bernard Hospital in Englewood. Thank you both for coming into the studio this morning.
Thank you so much for allowing us to talk about this.
You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. A lot of questions swirling around about Attorney General Jeff Sessions and his future. The Attorney General also has reversed an Obama administration Department of Justice directive not to prosecute in states that had legalized marijuana. That prompted Republican Senator Cory Gardner of Colorado to go after Sessions. He's warned that he will block all Justice Department appointees. Now, Cory Gardner is a Republican. He's also head of the Republican Senate Campaign Committee. He also personally opposes legalized marijuana, but he says it's a state's rights issue, and he says Jeff Sessions lied to him.
This is about a decision by the state of Colorado, and we were told that states' rights would be protected, and not just by the Attorney General, then the nominee to be Attorney General. We were told that by then-candidate Donald Trump. In fact, in Colorado, in July of 2016, President Trump was asked this question. When asked if President Trump, then candidate Trump, would use federal authority to shut down sales of recreational marijuana in states like Colorado, then candidate Donald Trump said, quote, I wouldn't do that. When asked if he, then candidate Trump, thinks Colorado should be allowed what to do what it's doing, then candidate Trump said, it's up to the states, absolutely. That was President, that was then candidate Trump's position. I would like to know from the Attorney General, why? What has changed? What has changed President Trump's mind that the Cole Memorandum would be reversed and rescinded? What has changed the President's mind? Why is Donald Trump thinking differently today about what he promised the people of Colorado in 2016? The reverse course today. What changed? I'd like to know that. I think the people of Colorado deserve to have that answer.
That's Republican Senator Cory Gardner of Colorado. Well, now joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Dr. Dan Lustig. He's the president and CEO of Haymarket Center. Doctor, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you and good morning.
First, let's start out, what is Haymarket Center?
Haymarket Center is a residential and outpatient substance abuse treatment and mental health program agency on the west side of Chicago. Haymarket serves about 14,000 clients a year come through our system. That being our main headquarters is a 400-bed residential complex. We have other locations up in Waukegan, up in Uptown, as well as a very long-term program working with the homeless and mentally ill individuals, triaging them out of O'Hare International Airport.
And, I mean, this is a nationally recognized program.
Absolutely.
New focus now, opioid epidemic. What's the cause?
Well, there's a lot of causes, primarily to what we're facing right now, which is the largest health medical epidemic this country's ever seen. You know, when you go back at least 10, 15, even 20 years, and you see the ramping up of prescription pain medications in this country, you began to see the level of addiction climbing exponentially each and every year. And so, you know, the lack of regulation in how pain medication was delivered has contributed greatly to this epidemic that we're seeing. It's also followed by the fact that many families and individuals don't throw out or dispose of properly opioid medication, pain medication. And for the collar counties, that primarily was the real emphasis of what contributed to the opioid crisis that we're seeing now in Illinois is pain medication.
What keeps fueling this epidemic?
So one most important issue is that heroin is inexpensive. So for individuals that are prescribed opioid painkillers for, you know, legitimate means and they run out, many individuals find themselves that they are addicted to these pain medications, and heroin is the next likely cheaper result of that. And that's contributing greatly.
In this ramping up, has that been a change in philosophy of doctors?
Ironically, many years ago, the American Medical Association actually looked at pain as the kind of fifth vital sign to be measured and dealt with as you're dealing with patients. When that occurred, managing pain was very personal. There's not a template that says your pain is different than my pain. And so what doctors were prescribing was these long-term pills of 30, 60, 90 days of pain medication that oftentimes people became addicted to. Most individuals will become addicted to pain medication usually after a week of using it as prescribed. So
after one week,
you're going to feel a little withdrawal when you come off of it. And so when you look at the lack of regulation of prescription medications, it has contributed a lot to what's impacting our families here in Illinois.
And we've seen lawsuits in the suburbs here in Illinois against pharmaceutical manufacturers over their role of trying to get their product distributed.
Correct.
I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
Absolutely. When you go back even 20 years, you see real strong marketing plans to physicians about using opioid pain medications. There was lots of marketing to many different doctors to prescribe these medications without any type of regulation or screening. What people and families don't realize is that if addiction runs in your family, there is a strong likelihood that you yourself will also become addicted. And we need to have those conversations. So if you have a family member whose mother or father was an alcoholic or who was a drug addict, it does predispose our children to very similar addictive type of exposure. We got to be careful of that. We've got to be able to screen accurately who and what type of patient we have in front of us.
Well, I started out with the clip from Cory Gardner from Colorado about the kind of crackdown on marijuana, and there's a big debate about the issue of, you know, can marijuana serve as an alternative? Because, I mean, there is a need for pain management, isn't
correct.
There?
Yes.
And so, you know, this seems to be a raging debate going on about expanding legalized marijuana for pain treatment. Illinois, of course, does have medicinal marijuana, is this a debate that's likely to be solved anytime soon?
It's a debate that has lots of tentacles to it. When you look at legalizing marijuana, it's important right now that our politicians begin to lead through scientific knowledge and not out of fear and not out of rumor and innuendo. We don't know how much marijuana treats conditions. We don't know, does a person take 20 milligrams, 50 milligrams? We don't know the scientific evidence of that. And that is a huge problem. When someone says that marijuana helps me with my glaucoma, marijuana helps me with my Parkinson's disease, what we should be thinking about is, what's that milligram? What is that exact dosage that's helping you with this? And that we don't know. The issue that we have now is that marijuana is becoming a funding issue. This is about adding money to needed services in many states across this country. We're not really having a debate about the usefulness of marijuana. We're having a debate that says marijuana brings tax money to the states without clearly understanding the consequences of long-term marijuana use. When you look at the marijuana that occurred in the early 60s and 70s, the amount of THC in marijuana in that time was about between 8 and 12%. Okay. Today, you're seeing THC contents in excess of 22%. And those kind of continued high-level dosage percentages has major consequences to that, up to including many beginning people who try marijuana at that dosage level experiences psychotic episodes. So you have co-occurring mental health conditions that can occur when you have individuals first using marijuana. So the message here is politicians need to look at the scientific evidence before they start laying down policy and law.
We're speaking with Dr. Dan Lustig. He's the president and CEO of Haymarket Center. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. And joining me here in the studio is Dr. Dan Lustig. He's president and CEO of Haymarket Center. Haymarket Center is the largest not-for-profit community-based adult detoxification, residential, and outpatient substance abuse treatment facility in Chicago. I was glad I could fit all that in, and it was not radio written. So, Doctor, we kind of laid the base here of talking about the opioid epidemic, and Haymarket is now looking to try to move out into DuPage County and provide some substance abuse treatment services there, specifically a facility in the southern part of Wheaton, a 16-unit facility. It has gotten support from some major players in DuPage County.
That is correct. We have gotten a lot of support. Let's just focus a little bit on why Wheaton, why now, and in Illinois last year alone, we've had 1,900 individuals die from opioid addiction, and that's just a startling number of people who have died. 1,900 people in our state have died due to opioid addiction. When you begin to look at DuPage, since 2013, we've had over 300 overdose reversals in DuPage, coupled by last year alone, close to 80 patients, 80 family members, 80 kids died because of opioid addiction.
And this is a number that's steadily increased in the last 3 years.
When you look at over the last 3 years, you've had double-digit increases across the county. This is an exact attack on our children and our families in DuPage County. And what is startling for me is I am baffled by the fact that counties continue to show resistance to opening up treatment facilities when the county and the area clearly see there's a need there. When you look at 8 bags of heroin being found outside of an Elmhurst High School, this is a war against our children. And we need to be wearing badges of honor when you want to talk about opening up a treatment facility. This is what should be happening right now in Wheaton, is that people and politicians should be wearing a badge of honor that says we are going to open up a comprehensive substance abuse and mental health service program for the county, to serve the county, because so many families out there have lost such young kids in their 20s, really, really smart kids, kids that were giving back to not only their community, but to their families and friends, are now gone.
Is part of the reluctance, one, just an unfamiliarity of the services that you provide?
I don't think it's that. I think the resistance comes from the fact of fear. I think people have the perception that a drug addict is this homeless, poor person that deserves to be, they had a choice to start using heroin, and they are the drugs of society, and they need to be casted aside. One thing we are very clear on the epidemic and its epicenter is it's reached every socioeconomic class in this country. Right now, you have more Caucasian kids that are dying from opioid addiction than any other race. So I think what people are not understanding, and the families that I've spoken to in DuPage County, they don't know where to turn when their child is impacted by addiction. They do not know where to turn. Many families in DuPage have remortgaged their homes to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars to get their children into treatment, not in DuPage County, out of the state, out of the county. Why not have a program that is both comprehensive and internationally known set of criteria that Haymarket Center abides by, having it in your own backyard, having a comprehensive treatment center close to home where family can support kids going through their program?
In this, is there having a facility like this, is that viewed in some respects as, well, maybe we don't want it in DuPage County because that reflects that there's a problem. And DuPage County, you know, always pro-growth, pro-everything, that it would represent in some respects a failure.
You know, I will tell you that early on, I think that might have been the issue, but so many of the leaders of DuPage know that there's a problem. So many of the leaders of DuPage, so many of the politicians want programming in their county. They understand that this is an epidemic, and they also understand that this needs to be fought here at home.
Well, you literally can't go into a doctor's office in DuPage County without seeing some kind of a poster or about, you know, signs, warning signs, you know. Be on the lookout for this.
When you look at addiction over the last 10 years, when you look at just, let's just take last year for an example. We lost 480,000 people to tobacco addiction. We lost 88,000 people due to alcohol addiction. And we lost another 60,000 to opioid addiction. If you times that over the last 10 years, we have lost millions of people to addiction. This is the time to able to provide a comprehensive approach to this epidemic. Let's bring comprehensive treatment to DuPage and, most of all, to those families whose children are impacted in DuPage.
Well, I mentioned that, and you, as you have as well, some prominent support from DuPage County leaders, Robert Berlin, the DuPage County State's Attorney in support of this, Dr. Richard Jorgensen, he's the DuPage County Coroner, very much in support of this, Evelyn Sanguinetti, the Lieutenant Governor of the State of Illinois, former Wheaton City Council member, also expressing support for this. And so there's a zoning hearing coming up on Tuesday, I believe.
Correct.
Where does this thing stand in your mind?
So, you know, it's a tough uphill battle. I think a lot of the residents are afraid of having a comprehensive program in their neighborhood. But they also need to understand that Haymarket Center is also an accredited agency. We are CARF accredited agency, which holds a set of international standards on care. So this is not a fly-by-night organization. This is an organization that's been around for over 43 years, was founded by Father Ignatius McDermott to provide the most comprehensive services to those that need it the most. I still think that there's a lot of shame and stigma attached to this disease, to this medical disorder. Let's keep that at the forefront, that this is a medical disorder that needs to be treated, and if it's not treated early enough, people will cycle in and out of their addiction for the next 30 years if we do not offer comprehensive services. I think people are afraid of that. I think, you know, once people get an understanding of who Haymarket is, what our approach is, we have 19 evidence-based interventions that run our programs here in Chicago. Many of those interventions are coming to DuPage. You will not find a treatment center in this country that has 19 evidence-based interventions inside their program.
Well, and you mentioned stigma, and I think, you know, as we've seen, and I'm sure you have as well, attitudes towards mental health have changed greatly, and that, you know, what was once viewed as, you know, just a weakness is now, you know, it is a medical issue. It's a real medical issue. This is a real medical issue.
And it's a huge cost to our society if left untreated. You know, when you start looking at the costs of mental health and addiction in this country, it's in the billions, billions of dollars. So getting people into treatment actually brings revenue back to counties and cities by getting people into be productive jobs again. There is lost revenue. There's huge costs to emergency rooms, to criminal justice systems. There are huge costs that can be improved if we get people into the right system of care. When you criminalize this disorder, that's not getting people into the right system of care. When you put people into an emergency room where all they're treating is the overdose and not long-term treatment, you're not putting people into the right system of care. The best care is to get them into a treatment program that focuses on addiction and mental illness.
That's Dr. Dan Lustig, President and CEO of Haymarket Center. Doctor, thank you so much for joining me on the Sunday Spin.
Thank you for helping lending a voice to this.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Under intense criticism from politicians who want his job, Governor Rauner has been residing at the Quincy Veterans Home. That's the facility that has been plagued by Legionnaires' disease outbreaks. Rauner has declined to say if he bears any moral responsibility for deaths that occurred there. There have been 13 deaths since 2015, an outbreak then. Resulted in the deaths of 12 people. Well, he's staying there as hearings begin in the legislature on Tuesday. We talked about that last week with Democratic State Senator Tom Cullerton. Now, the governor is staying in the Quincy Veterans Home, and by the governor's own words in the summer of 2016, if you're going to stay at a place which has had outbreaks of Legionnaires' disease, you'd probably want to do it in January, not in the heat and humidity of the summer.
We're really on top of the situation. The fact is, Legionella bacteria come from the river or the original water source. They're in the piping system throughout the Adams County and the city of Quincy. The bacteria there. The city treats the water. By the time it gets to us, the water can heat up. Bacteria thrive in warmer water. Warm water. This time of year, between the city's treatment facility and when it gets to this facility, it has to travel through a long distance of pipes. It gets warmed up. The chemical's ability to kill all the bacteria changes as the temperature increases. So we've got a dynamic situation that's very complex. All parties, the city's doing a great job. I believe this facility's doing a great job. But we're battling a little bacteria that's pretty tough. It is everywhere. And when temperatures go up and things are humid and warm, the bacteria can have an advantage.
That's Governor Rauner from the summer of 2016 after more Legionnaires' disease cases were discovered there. There were also a half dozen cases this year as well. Joining me now on the phone is Democratic Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy from Schaumburg, and the congressman is a member of the House Oversight Committee. Congressman, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Hey, good morning, Rick.
So I found it very interesting, this letter you wrote to Steve Bannon.
Yeah. It was quite a week, as you know. Steve Bannon told Mr. Wolf, the author of this recent book that came out on Friday, basically that he thought that the meeting between members of the Trump Organization and Russian-connected emissaries in the summer of 2016 at the Trump Tower was treasonous. As you know, that's a really serious charge, Rick. And
right.
When we heard that, you know, basically we wrote a letter to him asking him further questions about that issue and asking him if he'd be willing to meet with members of the Oversight Committee to talk about it further. We sent it on Friday. We haven't heard back yet, but I hope for a positive answer from him.
Do you think he will?
I don't know. You know, there's so much drama going on right now between Mr. Bannon and the president. And
Sloppy Steve.
Really,
I think it's Sloppy Steve, according to the president.
Sloppy Steve. I don't really know whether he would be willing to come and talk to members of Congress about this issue. But my guess is that Special Counsel Mueller will certainly want to talk to him. Others as well, and hopefully he can shed a little more light on what's going on and what he knew about, you know, Russian interference in our elections.
Well, and specifically in Wolf's book, he quotes Bannon as saying the three senior guys in the campaign thought it was a good idea to meet with a foreign government inside Trump Tower in the conference room on the 25th floor with no lawyers. Even if you thought that this was not treasonous or unpatriotic or bad stuff, and I happen to think it's all of that, you should have called the FBI immediately. And that's a quote from Steve Bannon there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this is like, I think this is politics and government 101. Whenever a foreign government wants to meet with you, or emissaries from a foreign government wants to meet with you, certainly on a presidential campaign, and if we think it's for illicit reasons, you should alert law enforcement, and that's what they should have done.
Where do you see this Mueller investigation going? I mean, we have the president repeatedly saying, no collusion, no collusion, no collusion. Yet, you know, every day we see different stories raising further questions about Russian involvement. We know from the intelligence community that the Russians were involved in our election process.
Yes. To his credit, Special Counsel Mueller has been somewhat tight-lipped about this. He's tried to avoid basically signaling where this is going, and I think it's in an attempt to, you know, really get to the bottom of what's going on with this Russian interference in our democracy issue, and whether there are any criminal acts that were committed. What I do know, which you probably already heard about, is that unfortunately Republicans in Congress have now launched an investigation in part through my committee, the Oversight Committee, the committee I sit on, to basically question the integrity of the FBI. And so literally before Christmas, I spent about 4 hours in closed door interviews of the deputy director of the FBI, questioning the FBI's handling of the investigation of Hillary Clinton's emails, of all things. And this appears to be an attempt to undermine the FBI, the credibility of Jim Comey, and ultimately Special Counsel Mueller. And so this rear guard action is very, very worrisome.
Well, and you know, we learn that the Justice Department says that it is reopening its look at the Hillary Clinton emails.
Right. Jeff Sessions has now started going down this route, although I think during his testimony about a month ago, he I think rightfully so, set a high bar, saying that, you know, we need more than just, a speculation, to restart an investigation into the Hillary Clinton email matter, to begin that. And, you know, I hope that he sticks to that standard. What I do know is that we are wasting a lot of time on this particular issue now in Congress. It seems like, Hillary Clinton's emails, seem to be at the center of their attempt to rally their base and undermine the FBI. And that's just wrong when we have such a bigger issue of Russian interference in our democracy to deal with.
But again, we have the president who says, well, this whole Russia thing's a hoax and it's fake news.
I can assure you this is not a hoax. And you know, the consensus opinion of the intelligence community, and this is, these are folks who are, across, numerous agencies in the federal government, is that the Russians did, interfere in our elections in 2016, that they likely are trying to do so in 2018 and in future elections, not only in the United States, but in other countries. And so we have to figure out, the extent of that, how do we protect against it, and whether folks here, met with them, came to an agreement on anything with regard to collusion and so forth.
Obviously, the president is still very fixated on Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
And I mean, as a Democrat in the minority party in the House, in Congress, when you kind of see what's going on with the White House, with, frankly, new turmoil every day, how can Republicans function in that kind of atmosphere? Because they also seem to be divided amongst themselves.
Well, I do think that some people are scratching their heads when they hear the president call himself a stable genius and so forth and his tweets. There's some very serious business that we have to attend to in January. Your listeners probably already know this, but the government is going to run out of money by January 19th. Our Dreamers, 800,000 or so, still don't have any kind of a solution to their plight. We don't have long-term funding of children's health insurance. And, you know, we don't even have a year-long budget for defense or discretionary spending. So these are very serious issues. I think there are Republicans who are trying to deal with this in a good faith way. And I think, these other, distractions don't help matters.
I want to talk to you more about, the issue of DACA because we have,
we have
that issue being tied, quite frankly, to, federal government funding as well. But,
yes.
We're going to do that right after we take a quick break. We're speaking with, Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, Democrat from Schaumburg. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Joining me on the phone, Democratic Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy from Schaumburg. Congressman, with meetings the past couple of days between the president and Republican leaders, we still have unresolved the issue of the DACA, the Dreamers, their efforts to try to see if that can't be part of a funding agreement for the government. Trump administration making it clear that border security has to be a significant element of any DACA resolution, including funding for the wall.
Yeah, I think that this wall issue is a non-starter for a lot of folks. In fact, you know, when I talk to Republicans in border states with Mexico, I'm talking about members of Congress or senators, they are almost uniformly opposed to any kind of a wall. I think that enhanced border security may be something that we can negotiate on, and certainly we always want to control our borders. But a wall is not the way to go. It sends a horrible message to the rest of the world, and not to mention it doesn't deal with the issue of how do people who are undocumented remain in this country. They usually overstay their visas. They don't come through the border. So in an undocumented fashion. So this is not the way to go.
Does the president's comments, does that undermine what had been bipartisan talks on trying to deal with DACA?
I think so. You know, back in, I think it was the early fall, when he spoke with the leaders of Congress about this Dreamer issue, I think that most folks thought he agreed that there should be kind of a clean Dreamer resolution, so to speak, or at least one that might involve some enhanced border security measures, but not a wall. And so now bringing this up, unfortunately, in my opinion, poisons the talks. And I'm hoping that he, you know, steps back from this particular position.
So when we get to the issue of government funding in January 19th, is DACA going to be part of it, or do Democrats say no DACA, no votes?
Well, you know, as you know, the Republicans control all branches of government at this point. They have the votes to pass funding, do the right thing by Dreamers and children's health insurance. I think that, as you know, the Dreamers status is in jeopardy at this point. In March, they'll be subject to deportation, 800,000 plus people who have known no other country is home, Rick. You know this. And so this is an issue that, in fact, many Republicans are concerned about, not to mention Democrats. I'm really hopeful that we can deal with this in a productive way.
I understand that this coming week you plan on introducing legislation called Investing in America American Workers Act, which involves a tax credit for companies that spend money
to
train their workers. Explain what this bill is and why it's needed.
So this is an issue that I care deeply about. Basically workforce training. Last summer, Republicans and Democrats working together passed a bill that I'm the lead Democrat on, which basically modernizes Perkins Career Technical Education. It basically is a bill that moves authority for spending federal dollars from Washington, D.C. to local states and municipalities. And it also makes sure that workers get training on skills that employers are validating at the time that the dollars are spent. This passed unanimously through the House in a significant bipartisan fashion, and now it's awaiting a vote in the Senate. We're following that up with this particular bill, which basically rewards companies who invest in their workers by providing a 20% tax credit on additional monies that they spent above what they have spent in the past. And so, again, I believe this is going to be a bipartisan measure. It continues our attempt to match workers who are, on the bench, so to speak, basically people who are graduating from high school, not necessarily going to college, four-year college, but who deserve their path to the middle class, with those jobs that are currently unfilled in the economy. There are about 6 million of them, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make our workers eligible to take those jobs, enhance their productivity, and ultimately gain a stronger foothold in the middle class.
You know, every campaign, it seems like a presidential campaign, there are more efforts to try to promote community colleges in kind of
yes.
that skill-based training and you know, lots of talk about pairing up community colleges with private employers. But I don't see a big impetus for that.
You know, it's happening, Rick. It's happening in different ways in different communities. However, you're right about one thing, which is that it could be a lot bigger, and it could be more widespread if only the federal government, which is the primary source of this funding for career technical education, laid out its plan and its vision for long-term funding in this particular area. And that is why I strenuously believe that the Senate should take up our bipartisan bill and pass it. I think the president will sign it. The White House has already signaled this. This bill is called the Thompson Krishnamurthy bill, the longest titled bill in Congress. And, we're hoping that it gets its vote. And if it does, there's billions of dollars sitting on the sidelines that private companies will invest in workforce training if only they can get further clarity on the government's plans in this area.
But, I mean, so, but what has taken so long, I guess? In this?
There's a belief in this country ever since World War II that four-year colleges were really the sole path or probably the primary path for workers or students to find their way into the middle class. And what we've seen after spending trillions and trillions of dollars on basically helping students to try to, American students to go to four-year colleges, that we still have only one-third of Americans who attended a four-year college. Two-thirds of Americans do not. And so the question is, are we going to find a path for them into a family-sustaining career and the middle class, or are we not? I think we have to. And the way to do that is to equip them with the skills to get access to the greatest social welfare program ever devised by human beings, a J-O-B, a job. We got to get them into a job. We got to equip them with the skills, the certification, and the tools to be able to take those jobs that remain unfilled in our economy.
That's Congressman Raja Krishnamurthy, Democrat from Schaumburg. Congressman, as always, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Rick.